The hour 9 o'clock has arrived, and so we will begin the February 17th, 2021 Board of Directors meeting for the Eastern Municipal Water District. And first I'm going to ask the clerk if she'd be so kind as to call the roll to make sure all our directors are here and that legal counsel is on the line.
Sure. Director Corona?
Here.
Director Slauson?
Here.
Director Armstrong?
Here.
Director Beckard? Director Beckard?
Here.
Legal counsel, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. I will then ask if we have an introduction of guests or anybody wishing to do public comment.
Good morning. We don't have any guests in the room. However, we do have several on the phone, including Jackie Melendrez with the City of Moreno Valley, Deputy CM, and representatives from Van Skoyak & Associates, as well as Danielle Kelly from March JPA.
Very good. Thank you so much. That we will go to our item two, which is a recognition and a proclamation of the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District honoring the life and service of Dr. Carla Thornton for her service of Moreno Valley. Mr. Jones.
Thank you, President Pauly. There we go. Is that better? Thank you, President Pauly, members of the board. Good morning. We have unfortunately, bringing forward a proclamation of the Board of Directors, Eastern Municipal Water District, honoring the life and service of Dr. Carla J. Thornton for her service in the City of Moreno Valley. And I'd like to read the proclamation, and then I know Director Slauson may want to make some comments regarding Dr. Thornton, who's an absolute leader in the community and unfortunately passed away recently. Whereas Dr. Carla J. Thornton represented District 2 on the Moreno Valley City Council from December 2018 until the time of her passing in January 2021, and during her tenure on Moreno Valley City Council, Dr. Thornton established herself as a highly respected community leader who sought to provide a better future for the residents of Moreno Valley. Dr. Thornton was the first African-American woman to serve on the Moreno Valley City Council and was a proud veteran of the United States Air Force, where she retired after 20 years of service with the rank of Master Sergeant. Dr. Thornton successfully incorporated her policy priorities, including Veterans Affairs, infrastructure, and homelessness, as she helped create the City of Moreno Valley's Hire a Mobile Veteran Program. Dr. Thornton was a steady voice on the Moreno Valley City Council who believed in collaboration and the importance of being actively involved within the community she served. Dr. Thornton was always willing to engage the community and listen to better understand different perspectives on issues so she could make an educated, well-informed decision. And during her time interacting with the community, she was quick with a smile and brought a very positive outlook to every interaction. Dr. Thornton's leadership and commitment to the residents of Moreno Valley will be greatly missed by all those who knew her and who she represented. And therefore, be it proclaimed that the Board of Directors, on behalf of the management staff, honor Dr. Thornton for her service to the City of Moreno Valley and this region, and certainly was a strong supporter of EMWD, and we're certainly going to miss her in the community. Director Slauson, would you like to say a few words?
Sure. I would just add, I met with her several times, and she was a local girl. She graduated from Canyon Springs High School, product of Moreno Valley, highly intelligent, went on to serve in the military, getting her master's degree and teaching at Cal Baptist as, an assistant professor. So she was a bright light. She brought that to the city council. She cared about the community, and she'll be missed. She was really friendly and nice and fun to be around. So,
yeah. Very good. Thank you. April, do our guests on the phone want to make any comments?
Jackie Melendrez, do you have any comments that you'd like to add?
Yes, I'd like to. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you. I'd like to thank the board for honoring the memory and the life of Dr. Carla Thornton on behalf of the mayor and the city council. think you did an amazing job of capturing her life and capturing her memory. I recently spoke to some students about her, and I had the pleasure to be at her memorial service and to hear all the wonderful things that people had to say about her and all of the positive interactions that folks had with her to remember her and to honor her memory and all of the communities that she served. She truly was a leader, and we thank you for honoring her with this proclamation today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
April, any other folks on the phone?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Very good. Thank you very much. I was remiss, and I forgot the most important part of our meeting, which is our Pledge of Allegiance. So if we could all stand, and Director Armstrong this morning has agreed to lead us in the pledge. So,
please join me. Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you for that and our recognition, and that will take us into item three, which is our executive reports. And Mr. Jones.
Two items I'd like to update the board on. The written report is included in your board package. One was we had previously reported to the board that we are working with the County of Riverside to secure a portion of the federal funding from the March 2020 CARES Act, the first stimulus passed by the federal government to assist EMWD low-income customers with COVID-19-related utility debt. The funding from the county for this type of assistance comes through a community action partnership department within the county. That program that we coordinated with them provides a one-time payment to an eligible customer's outstanding debt and basically pays down all their outstanding debt and makes that payment directly to the district. After several months of coordination with the county on this, the program is up and running. And in fact, I did want to report that the district received its first group of payments from this for 27 customer accounts where they cleared those delinquent accounts, and the payments were around $12,000 for us. So I think that's good. So April and her team are now going to continue to coordinate with customer service for those customers who are in a disadvantaged income situation to be able to apply for this program. And hopefully now that we have this set up, as further stimulus funding has come from the federal government, we now have a mechanism in place where we can assist our customers more directly through this county program. Second item I just wanted to report, staff's been actively engaged in the last couple of months with a metropolitan water district in a work group process that they've set up to reevaluate MET's rate structure. The initial focus of the group is to develop a replacement for a component of MET's rate structure known as the water stewardship charge. That charge funded local resource programs, so the LRP agreements for the projects, also all their conservation programs are funded through that rate component. The MET board suspended the collection of that component of the rate in 2018. That was a result of the San Diego County Water Authority's litigation, which disallowed the collection of that rate component on the exchange water that San Diego brings into the service area from the Imperial Irrigation District. So the MET board suspended the collection of that rate component on all its sales and directed its staff to develop an alternative funding mechanism to come back and fund local resource programs, conservation programs, and water resource programs that Metropolitan provides incentives for, and that they wanted something developed and brought back kind of for the next biennial rate setting process in 2022. So MET has set up a working group. They brought in an outside facilitator who's also an economist and a rate expert, and they have met three times. One of the things we pushed for was, before you got into looking at the mechanics of a new type of rate, was to kind of back up and look at some guiding principles. In other words, an overarching principles that any rate proposal could be tested against. So the Met staff did move in that direction. We worked and coordinated with a group of 14 Met member agencies and prepared guiding principles. Those were reviewed yesterday along with guiding principles offered by other agencies. They're fairly broadly accepted, and the Met staff is going to consolidate those guiding principles and then do a check-in with the Met board to say, is these the principles that we want to use to look at any changes to the rate structure? So this got off to a bit of a rocky start. I think it's in a really good direction now. We're going to give a full update to the admin committee and the board in March, but I want to let you know it looks like this is back on the right path again. And with that, are there any other questions on my report or comments?
I have a question. Just sure. since you discussed Met, it's not related to the rates, but you know, being a member agency of Met, just seeing press in articles in the paper over the last couple of weeks about some concerning things. I'm wondering if there's an opportunity, appropriate forum where this board could get updated, maybe in more depth on what's happening there. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah, there's been multiple articles in the LA Times regarding employee-related issues. Of course, you know, that's closed session. A lot of that within Met and its HR-related or personnel-related issues. But I think we can, and let me think about what the best way to give you that update would be. Well, certainly don't have, you know, the details of the confidentiality, but I know there's a number of very, very proactive things that Met has done. And this, it's interesting because what was reported in the paper are things that have happened quite a while ago. Much of this has come to the board. There's been steps taken, including hiring outside independent investigator to look into these things, and they've really systematically done this. And some of that's kind of open session type material, and so we can certainly brief you on that. But I think there's what when I looked at those articles, what was disappointing to me, it really didn't get into all the steps that have been taken immediately when these issues came forward and that have been very positive, I think, in addressing these issues. And Director Record may want to make a comment on this as well.
Well, I know there's always more to it, and that's why I was wondering if we could get maybe the other side of the story. Somehow.
Sure. So, okay.
And then, Paulie did not have a question, but just a quick comment to again.
Sorry about that. Having technical issues this morning.
Go ahead, Director Record.
I'm happy to comment at some point, Paul. I think you captured it pretty well. It's a typical newspaper story that isn't really the full picture, and when you determine what the appropriate venue is for us to have a discussion about it. I'm happy to be a part of that. But needless to say, it's very disappointing. I can say that staff has worked for a long time with this recorder, and, you know, obviously their job is to sell newspapers. So we'll see what happens from here.
Okay. Thank you, Director Record. And then I just wanted to add some kudos to April and her staff. During the Super Bowl a couple Sundays ago, I was going through Twitter and saw some really great ads that we put together to highlight the fact that while you're enjoying the Super Bowl, we're doing our jobs and making sure things go where they're supposed to go. And it highlighted a lot of our rank-and-file line employees. And so I just thought that was a great little social media thing we did on Twitter. So I just wanted to do a shout out to April and Amanda Fine and everybody for that. So, any other comments?
Yeah.
For comments, Mr. Jones?
Questions.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Question? Very good. Laura, do you have anything for us this morning?
Nothing this morning.
I know you're saving your fire for a little more down the agenda line. Nick, good morning.
I have nothing to report today.
Very good. Joe?
Good morning. Nothing today.
And Mr. Wall?
Yes, I have something.
Okay.
Real briefly, we started discharging recycled water last Wednesday at a rate of about 11 MGD. We're currently at 90% full in our storage, 2.1 billion gallons. It's the most we've ever had in storage. So we've done our best to put off discharge if at all possible. Currently our sales are about 13 million gallons per day, and we're at that time of year when sales will generally start taking off. There's a little bit of rain in the forecast 10 days out, so that, as you know, could obviously change pretty radically. So we're hopeful that the discharge will be very limited and we'll be able to cease discharge operations within a week or two. That's hopeful. So anyhow, we're in pretty good shape right now. Again, a lot of water in storage. Our sales are higher. As last January, our sales are about 50% higher than they were the two previous years. So there's a couple of good metrics there that are making me a little more optimistic. And again, weather dependent, we will hopefully be able to turn off the discharge here in a couple of weeks. That's all I have.
Okay. Very good. With that, we'll go to item number four on the agenda, which is our presentations on our 2021 federal issues update. I believe Jolene Walsh is on the phone.
She is going to introduce our guest today.
Okay, very good.
Good morning, President Pauley and members of the board. Before you for a virtual presentation today is Pete Evitt, our lead lobbyist from Vanscoyac Associates. Vanscoyac typically does an annual in-person presentation, but considering what's happening right now, we've opted for a virtual presentation. As many of you know, VSA has represented EMWD in Washington, D.C. for about 15 years, and they've helped Eastern secure extensive funding for many of our infrastructure projects. And with that, Pete, please take it away.
Great. Thank you so much, Celine. Before I start, is it, can everyone hear me okay?
We can, yes.
Great. Well, thank you, Board President Pauley, Director Drecker, Corona, Armstrong, Slauson, and General Manager Jones. On behalf of Vanscoyac Associates, I'd like to extend our appreciation for this opportunity to present to you today. If we could turn to the next slide, that would be great. So before beginning my remarks, I want to recognize the other key members of VSA's federal team for Eastern who are also on the line listening in and can answer questions at the end of the presentation. And those are my colleagues, Jeff Bowman and Ashley Strobel. While Jeff is a familiar presence, Ashley is a new member of our team, having come on board this past fall. We're pleased to have her and the contributions she's making to advance the district's federal relations priorities. So I'm going to start first by providing an update on our efforts associated with the South Paris Desalter Project, which we also refer to as a program since it entails more than one specific project. Securing federal funding for this initiative has been a high priority for the district for many years, and we have had some significant developments as of recent. As a quick backgrounder, the district's South Paris Brackish Desalination Project was originally authorized by Congress in the year 2000 for $25 million. As a result of successive years of receiving appropriate funding through the Army Corps of Engineers budget, the project is now approaching its statutory federal cap. As Eastern has future plans to expand its desalination program, our team has been assisting the district in a multi-step process to double its existing congressional authorization for the project from $25 million to $50 million. After going through an application process and formally securing what I'll call an endorsement by the Corps to increase the project's authorization level, the next step was working with Eastern's House and Senate delegation and key congressional committees to advocate for the inclusion of language to increase the project's authorization as part of a major federal water measure. That water legislation, called the Water Resources Development Act, or WRDA, began working its way through Congress in 2019 and into 2020. We had tremendous success in this endeavor as legislative language doubling the project's authorization made its way into the House, Senate, and ultimately the final version of the WRDA bill. This culminated in the South Paris provision being included in the massive FY21 omnibus COVID relief package that President Trump signed into law on December 27th. So next slide, please. In a parallel effort, we set forth over the last year to secure the remaining $4.75 million in funding for the parish project as part of its original $25 million authorization. In working very closely with the Corps at its three levels, district, division, and headquarters, and also with Eastern's congressional delegation, we learned on January 19th that we were successful in securing the entire $4.75 million allocation as part of the Army Corps' FY21 work plan. To provide some context to this achievement, South Paris was the only project of its kind to be funded in the Army Corps' budget document from the entire state of California. Additionally, at $4.75 million, it was one of the largest of the 27 awards contained in the work plan for the project type. These funds will allow the district to complete construction on key water transmission pipelines tied to the desalter facilities. So recognition of both of these project successes, the authorization increased, and robust funding, and the robust funding award goes to the entire Eastern team, as these achievements were several years in the making. And of course, they would not have been possible without the steadfast support from Eastern's House and Senate delegation, Senators Feinstein, Reps Calvert, Takano, Rees, and former Senator Harris championed the project every step of the way. So with that, we can go to the next slide. So I'm going to shift topics now and talk about the political landscape shift in Washington in the aftermath of the 2020 election. While it took until early January for the balance of power in the Senate to be determined, as we know, the Democrats came out on top and now control the executive legislative branches of government. At the administration level, the Biden White House, this means there's going to be changes in both the direction and leadership of all departments and agencies, including those overseeing federal programs and policies. So regarding nominations and key agency appointments, Biden has selected Deb Haaland of New Mexico to head up the Department of Interior. Haaland would be the first Native American to ever lead that agency. Two noteworthy Department of Interior appointments announced on January 20th were the selections of Tanya Trujillo to serve as Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Water and Science, and Camille Touton as Deputy Commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation. In recent years, Trujillo served as a project director for the Colorado River Sustainability Campaign, also as the executive director of the Colorado River Board, California. Touton previously worked as a professional staff member on three different congressional committees with jurisdiction over water policy and programs. Trujillo and Touton, both of whom Eastern knows has worked closely with over the years, also held key water roles in the Interior Department under the Obama administration. In regard to EPA, President Biden has selected Michael Reagan, who is the head of the North Carolina's Department of Environmental Quality, to lead the agency. Biden also appointed Deka Fox to be the Principal Deputy Assistant Administrator of the Office of Water at EPA. Fox had been CEO of the U.S. Water Alliance and prior to that worked with the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. So she, like Trujillo and Tuchin, is someone who Eastern is very familiar with. So we can turn to the next slide. As it relates to West water issues, we can expect the Biden administration to focus on water conservation, efficiency, reuse, and desalinization. This administration's policies will be driven by purported impacts of climate change on water supply, and there will be an emphasis on climate-associated resiliency measures. In addition, we expect there will be greater scrutiny in relation to the development of large-scale water storage projects. PFAS chemical pollution, which is a topic of interest to the district, has been outlined as a Biden administration priority. The administration looks favorably upon designating PFOS and PFOA as hazardous substances under Superfund law, as well as establishing maximum contaminant limits for those two PFAS chemicals. Next slide, please. On Capitol Hill, the new Democratic majority in the Senate fell narrow at 50-50, 51 votes, when you count Vice President Harris's tie-breaking vote, will allow congressional Democrats, in tandem with President Biden, to set the legislative policy agenda. Senate Republicans have a powerful tool in the filibuster, which takes 60 votes to overcome, and that's a means to block most legislation they oppose. However, under a process where the filibuster cannot be invoked, which is called budget reconciliation, congressional Democrats can pass high-profile items, including tax provisions, emergency or infrastructure spending, and health care reform through a simple majority vote. The filibuster-proof budget reconciliation process is what congressional Democrats are currently used to advance President Biden's proposed $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. The White House and Congress are moving full speed ahead on this COVID response measure, which is on track to be enacted by the first or second week of March, and what is currently anticipated to be a straight party line vote. Next slide, please. So details of the House version of the almost $2 trillion COVID package were released last week. As the district has seen significant increases in the rate of customers who are delinquent on their bills, a few key provisions included in the legislation of interest to Eastern are a $500 million application, formula-based low-income water and wastewater ratepayer assistance program. This program will be administered by the Department of Health and Human Services. The $500 million will be combined with $635 million that was enacted in the COVID relief package Congress passed and President Trump signed into law at the end of December. There is also $19 billion headed to states and local governments for rental assistance to eligible households. These funds can also be used to pay utility bills. The $19 billion, that's its bill, is in addition to $25 billion that was included for this same program in the COVID legislation.
You've been muted. To unmute yourself, press star 6.
In the bill, an aid to states, cities, and counties.
You are no longer muted.
Special districts. However, there is a provision in the measure that allows localities to transfer a portion of their allocation to special districts. Next slide, please. Following the pending enactment of the COVID relief package, Congress will be in the process of moving a large-scale infrastructure bill. Last year's House climate-focused infrastructure measure called the Moving Forward Act, H.R. 2, is expected to be the guide as Congress develops this year's legislation. The Moving Forward Act proposed more than $1 trillion in new spending for infrastructure and included billions of dollars for water and wastewater grant and programs. As part of the Moving Forward Act, there was increased funding for the Bureau of Reclamation's Title 16 program, Water Smart and Desalination program. Also seeing significant boost as part of that legislation were EPA's SRF accounts and sewer overflow and stormwater reuse grant program. Additionally, there was a first-time funding for what would be a new nationwide water reuse and recycling grant program. And there was also a new EPA grant account to assist water agencies in efforts to remediate for PFAS found in drinking water systems. It's expected that congressional Democratic leadership will move the infrastructure package in the same manner as the COVID-19 legislation, which is via the budget reconciliation rules. So while they will try to pull in some Republican support, Biden and congressional Democratic leadership won't necessarily have to negotiate Republican lawmakers, and therefore will be able to shape the measure to their size and meaning. Next slide, please. It is being reported by credible sources that a plan for Congress to bring back earmarks is expected to be rolled out as early as next week. We will be keeping Eastern informed when this announcement is formally released. We'll be ready to go once more details and guidance are issued. And we'll be working with the district very closely on potential funding opportunities this present. as this is going to be a congressional Democrat-initiated move, it will be interesting to see if Republican lawmakers decide to participate in the plan. Next slide, please. Here we're just shining a light on each congressional delegation at their committee roles in the 117th Congress. Representative Albert is going to reprise his role as the ranking member of the House Appropriations Committee's defense subpanel. Will also continue to serve on the Energy and Water Appropriations Subcommittee. Rep. Takano is to be the chair of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, and will retain his position as a member of the Energy and Commerce Committee. That has jurisdiction over PA, Safe Drinking Water Act issues, and Drinking Water SRF. Next slide, please. Rep. return to Congress means return once again as House representation in the Temecula area. He will be serving on the Judiciary Committee, where he is a ranking member of one of its subpanels, and he's also on the Foreign Affairs Committee. Senator Feinstein is the chair of the Senate Energy and Water Appropriations Subcommittee, which funds the Bureau of Reclamation and Army Corps of Engineers. She was the ranking member, and now the Democrats taking control, she is now the chair. And then lastly, Senator Padilla secured a seat on the Senate Environment Works Committee. EPW, as it is known, has jurisdiction over the Environmental Protection Agency and Army Corps of Engineers, amongst other agencies. So we look forward to build a relationship with him, his office, and getting him acquainted with the district's federal priority issues and projects. That same sentiment goes with Representative Issa, who at one time represented Eastern. So we're happy to have him back, being one of our House representatives. And lastly, I just wanted to let you know that we'll be working on setting dates to conduct Eastern's first round of congressional and federal agency advocacy meetings. These will need to, once again, be virtual engagements. So, like many of us, I look forward to when we start doing face-to-face meetings again. It's hard to predict when that will be allowed to happen, but I remain hopeful. Fingers crossed it will be sometime before the end of the year. So with that, that concludes my remarks, and we're happy to answer any questions that the board may have.
Do we have any questions for Pete?
President Pauley, I have a couple of questions.
Director Record? Go ahead.
Good to hear from you, Pete. As far as the California Senate representatives, Senator Feinstein has been under a lot of pressure from her party about her leadership roles. Do you expect that she'll be able to retain her chairmanship of that committee?
Well, yes, she did lose her position as the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. But this was actually just recently formally announced that she is going to be the chair of the subcommittee for energy and water appropriations, under the full Senate Appropriations Committee. So fortunately, it didn't impact her role there, and, she is going to have that position, which is a key position is, as I mentioned, it funds the Bureau of Reclamation and Army Corps programs and projects. So.
That's great. As far as Senator Padilla, over the years working with him within the state, I always found him to be very engaging, very bright, and a good listener. And so really excited to see him there, and hopefully we can reestablish a relationship and have a couple of great senators from California working on water.
Yeah, we've heard the same sentiments about him, and we're looking forward to working with him and getting him acquainted with our issues and priorities, and being on Environment and Public Works is a good sign. That was the committee that former Senator Boxer was on for a long time and became the chair of that committee, and so it always seemed like we always had a Californian there. So I agree with those sentiments. Director Record.
Thank you.
Pete, It's Phil Pauley. I just wanted to go back and circle back on one item that you talked about, and that is the federal COVID dollars that could be used by special districts to make up for lost revenue from rates. I'd like to just have you keep a close eye on that. I also know that usually when federal money comes, it also comes with some federal strings attached to it. So I want to make sure before we dive into that, that the board is fully aware of all the particulars that come with that program. So if you could keep an eye on that for us, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And just in the nature of time, I didn't also mention that there was recently in the last, I believe, week or so, the bill that Representative Garamendi introduced last year on the House side that would provide special district COVID funding. He reintroduced that, and then there's a Senate companion to that, which was introduced by Senators Sinema of Arizona and Cornyn of Texas. So I think they're going to keep pushing ahead, but I understand where you're coming in terms of the strings. And so we're definitely keeping a close watch on that, and we'll continue to do so.
Very good. Anything else for our federal team? With that, I thank you. It's always would always be better to have you here in person, but I understand, so I appreciate the update. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. We look forward to in person again as well. We appreciate it. Thank you all.
Very good. With that, we'll go to item 4B, which is a March Joint Powers Authority activity update, and I believe Ms. Walsh.
Yes, she'll be introducing Dr. Danielle Kelly, the Executive Director of the March Joint Powers Authority.
Great. Hello again. We have Dr. Danielle Kelly with us this morning to provide an update on the March Joint Powers Authority. And while March JPA generally has kind of a lower profile in the community, they are very busy and very hard at work on many excellent projects, and many of their projects overlap with ours, so we thought it was timely for Dr. Kelly to provide us an update. She's been with the Joint Powers Authority for about 18 years, and in her former life was a Marine and lived in Washington, D.C., but we're happy she's here with us. So, Danielle?
Good morning.
Good morning. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, you can.
Hello? Oh, excellent. Well, thank you for this opportunity to present this morning. Excited to tell you about what we're up to. Next slide, please. So as a brief overview, this is the colored map of what used to be March Air Force Base. I'm sure everybody knows it was realigned as a result of the base realignment and closure round of 1993, officially realigned April 1st, 1996. The white area you see around the flying facilities was retained by March Air Reserve Base, about 2,200 acres. Approximately 4,400 acres were declared surplus. And of that 4,400 acres, March JPA received 3,500 acres to redevelop. You might ask, what's the delta there between the 35 and 4,400? If you look at those kind of orangey tan shaded areas, the one on the bottom left is the Ben Clark Training Center that went directly to Riverside County, and the one kind of in the middle right is about a 90-acre park that went to the city of Moreno Valley. Next slide, please. We operate a lot like a city does. We have a board of commissioners, and it's comprised of two elected officials from each of these four jurisdictions: the County of Riverside, City of Moreno Valley, City of Paris, and the City of Riverside. Unlike a municipality, we do not receive any tax increment, sales tax, property taxes. We're fully self-funded by our own operations. In addition to the Joint Powers Authority, we're also an airport authority, a utility authority, and we're the successor agency to the former March Joint Powers Redevelopment Agency. Next slide, please. So what's our purpose? If you think about military property, it's federal property. It's not on the tax rolls. It's not creating any value as far as property taxes for the local jurisdictions. Right now, we create about a billion dollars worth of development that is currently taxed on the property rolls. At build-out, we're projected to create about $7 billion worth of building valuation and 32,000 jobs. Next slide, please. We have three key planning areas. Next. So they're broken up. The red area is Meridian Business Park. It goes from Alessandro to south of Van Buren Boulevard on the left. On the right bottom is the blue area is the airport property, and the green area is March Life Care Campus on the northeast corner. And that's kind of bounded by Cactus Avenue and Hecox. Next slide. So how do we do all this without any property taxes? We have public-private partnerships that we've successfully leveraged over the years. Meridian Business Park is currently being developed by a partnership between Waypoint and Lewis. We have March Life Care Campus being developed by March One LLC. And March and LaPorte, our airport, is being developed by Hillwood, which is a Ross Perot company out of Texas. Next slide. So Lewis Waypoint is currently developing about a 35-acre parcel that you're looking at Cactus Avenue south towards the base. It's a 685,000-square-foot industrial building. Upon completion, it'll be up to 900 employees, more likely 400 to 500. They're courting refrigeration-type uses right now. Next slide, please. March and LaPorte. Next. So we have about 350 acres that straddles the runway. The left side or the west side is along Interstate 215. It does not have any flying facilities connecting it to the airfield, so there's no taxiways or ramps on that side. So we've primarily developed that for industrial purposes. And on the far north end of that, you might be able to tell that Marchfield Air Museum is actually on our property and one of our tenants. On the east side, the 165 acres, we do have a legacy B-52 ramp, about 1 million square feet, and I'll talk a little bit about more about that. Next slide. So the east side, we currently have a DDI, which is a 225,000-square-foot warehouse facility. We also have Amazon and AMRO in the old DHL facility, if you all were around long enough to remember that place. Next. We have Amazon flies about 5 flights per day right now. We have UPS flies their Christmas overflow from Thanksgiving to Christmas Day out of our property. We have Omega Air, which is a contract Navy refueler. They operate a lot like the KC-135s do on the base. And then we have a new contract refueler, Consolidated Air Support Systems, that is working on a contract with the Air Force and the Navy to also provide air refueling. We are a joint-use airfield, so there's a civilian side and a military side, and I am proud to say that we supported over 439 commercial aircraft that were actually on the military flight line servicing about the 40,000 Army troops that were heading up to Fort Irwin in 2019. I don't have the numbers yet for 2020, but I think it went up. Next slide. So this is a busy one. Can you hit that again? Click it again. Oh, I'm sorry. Go back. I'm missing some of my pop-up boxes. So we have the authorization to fly 21,000 operations. An operation is equal to a landing or a takeoff. Right now, we operate at about 18% of our capacity that we're allotted. You can see here that we had about 3,800 operations last year. And on the bottom left, you can kind of see the breakdown between commercial, single, twin, jet engines, helicopters. Next slide. We received a grant from Federal Aviation Administration to put in 150,000-square-foot ramp and terminal facility for general aviation. So we are truly open to the public. Next slide. Here's our terminal. Next. picture on the inside. And just a fun fact, those pictures up on the ceiling there are actually old photographs from March that we had blown up. Next slide. We have Hillwood on the left side or the west side of the runway. They were just entitled for a 2 million square foot industrial facility. Target's going to be the leaser of that property, and it's a projected additional 2,000 jobs to the area. Next slide. Meridian Business Park. Next. It's a 1,290-acre master planned development. It goes from Alessandro to south of Van Buren. It's broken. Van Buren kind of bifurcates the project, so we have North Campus, South Campus, and then that gray part to the west is Upper Plateau. Next slide. Some current projects. We have Moshe Salagi. He's developed about a 33,000 square foot office, retail, business park. That was approved. If you drive down Van Buren, they're almost at certificate of occupancy at this point. Next slide. We have Greens Group that's developing restaurants and hotels and some retail right at the intersection of Van Buren and the 215. That's where the In-N-Out and Starbucks is, and their hotel is under construction right now. I think I have a picture of it on the next slide. Yep. So hotel, In-N-Out, next slide. So Meridian South Campus, that's Van Buren Boulevard looking to the east. The red circle is the Commons. It's a shopping area. I believe they have Farmer Boys, 7-Eleven, a gas station in there right now. They were just recently entitled for a grocery store to go in there as well. The yellow building is a million-square-foot UPS parcel delivery terminal. The shell is constructed. They have been working on tenant improvements on the inside for quite some time now. The blue square is a million-square-foot Amazon facility. They are completely up and operational. Next slide. March Life Care Campus. Next. It's a, go ahead, one more. Thank you. 160-acre, fully entitled medical campus, everything from general medical office to mixed-use, institutional, residential. Next slide. So Signature Healthcare has been entitled for quite some time now. They submitted their construction plans early last year, and due to the price of steel being much higher than they anticipated, they've had to go back and rework their project. For medical projects, you have to go through the state OSHPD process, which does take some time, but it will be a 100,000-square-foot facility with about 150 beds. Next slide. There's a rendering of it. Next. We have a 75-bed facility. It's a physical rehabilitation, head trauma recovery facility in escrow right now. They will also have to go through the OSHPD process, so you're not going to see any type of construction on that one for a couple of years either. Next slide. The master developer has put in a 4,300-foot, 12-inch water line for additional pressure out there. As you can imagine, the base being over 100 years old and this being the oldest part of the base, the pipes out there aren't that great, and they certainly don't meet water pressure requirements for modern fire flow. Next slide. So the physical impacts of March JPA. Our current direct economic impact is about $484 million a year. You can see the tax increment that we've generated from property taxes. These are the big ones. The local jurisdictions are like police, fire, the water districts. At build out, we're projected to have a direct economic impact of $4.6 billion per year. Next slide. We're involved in a lot of capital improvements. I think because the four jurisdictions comprise our board and none of them want to tackle them individually, so they throw it at the JPA. Hecock Channel, this right here is JFK and Hecock, and that's about a 15-foot deep channel right there. That wasn't even a 5-year storm. So the project started in fall of 2017. It was complete in 2018. Next. You can see it flooding Hecox Street. Next. It flooded the base's water egress cleanup system. Next. And here's how beautiful it is today. We're very proud of that. Next slide. We also donated 14 acres to RCTC for the Moreno Valley March Field Station. That's been operational for quite some time. Next. We worked very closely with RTA to get a bus terminal and route to service this area. Next. Did it click? It goes. So that's the route it goes from Moreno Valley Mall through Orange Crest and back to the Metrolink site. Next slide. You might have thought it was Caltrans that improved the Van Buren interchange. It was actually March Joint Powers Authority that was able to pull this project together. We're always looking for ways to protect the base in the next base realignment and closure round. And this is one perfect example. So the previous bridge was built too high and it projected into the airspace for March. And they had to have operate under a waiver for the military. So when we rebuilt the bridge, we lowered it a couple of feet so that they no longer have that negative mark against them of operating under a waiver. Next slide. We've also been very busy widening and reconstructing the road from the 215 all the way to Barton Avenue, and that is complete, except for some landscaping at this point. Next slide. We're a foreign trade zone. That is an economic development tool for companies that operate inside the United States but want to take the tax advantages of as if they were outside the United States. And I have to say, since Jackie's on the line, Moreno Valley has been really excellent in promoting this program. So just by using foreign trade zone procedures, for example, Skechers saves over $1 million a year, and that's money that they can put back into their business, back into the community. And I'd just like to point out that we had $2.9 billion worth of product shipped through the zone in 2019. Next slide. U.S. Vets Initiative. Next slide. So they used to occupy a barracks. They still do. This is their overflow barracks. It was about 111 men only. Next. March JPA donated almost 8 acres and $10 million for their overall March Veterans Village. The new village will house up to 400 veterans, their families, children. Next. This is what the campus will look like at build-out. Next. These two buildings have already been constructed. Next. And they have a third under construction right now. Next. And lastly, I would just like to thank the board for their longtime support of projects at March. I know we have several interconnects and more to come. And we really appreciate you facilitating our development. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a great presentation. Board members, are there any questions or comments for Dr. Kelly?
I think it was a good presentation. It's nice to know what's going on at March.
Director Record, anything from you?
Yes, Dr. Kelly, good presentation. Thank you. I'm wondering if you have any concerns about, I don't know how much more air traffic Amazon is going to be providing, but any issue with the Air Reserve being able to do all the flights they need to do? I think there's only one runway there, so does that cause any concern?
There is one runway. Like I said, we're authorized up to 21,000 operations per year. That was negotiated with the Air Force and the FAA when we were designated a joint use air facility. We're only at 18% right now. I believe Amazon is allowed up to 7 flights per day, so it's really only 2 more aircraft coming in and out at this point that are slated. Realistically, all of our parking spots are already taken on the ramp, so unless we're able to expand in some capacity, which is, you know, financially not feasible at this point, I'm not sure how we could even entertain much more than we already have.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, again, thank you, Dr. Kelly, for your time this morning. That was very informative, and it's a very good update, so
thank
I appreciate
you.
It. Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. With that, we will go to our consent calendar. Does any of the board members wish to remove an item for further discussion?
Yeah, I would like to have a discussion on item D, 5D.
On 5D, okay. Any other board members with a consent calendar issue or?
I'd like to pull item B.
Pull item B, okay. So we have B and D for further discussion or a conflict of interest?
Just discussion.
Okay, very good. With that, could we have a motion on the consent calendar except for items B and items D?
I'd make that motion.
Correct? I'll second.
The motion is made by Director Corona and seconded by Director Armstrong. Madam Clerk, could you call the roll, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
And that passes 5-0. We will now go back and let's take item B first. Director Corona?
Yeah, I'm inclined to be in favor of this. I just wanted another, you know, I brought up the Quality Turf lease before, and I'd like to bring up this one again. Am I correct in the lease amount to be $27 an acre?
It's correct per year.
That is just incredibly low. And I know it may not be the best ground in the whole world, but I just I think that when we advertise this, when it comes up, you know, like I said, I'm going to vote in favor of it in 6 months. I think we may need to note what the current rate is being paid. I think if people know that it's going so cheaply, that you may get more people interested.
Well, we have advertised it in the past when we originally did our solicitation and our original contract with Mr. Bean. Mm-hmm. That was the best bid that we got at the time. We're doing a six-month extension. That's what we're proposing, so he can finish out his crop, and then we will do a broad advertisement again, and we'll certainly consult with you if you think we need to. Mechanism of advertising isn't sufficient.
No, I think
this is what the market was bearing at the time.
It's a great rate for him.
Bear in mind, this is not designed to be specifically a revenue source for us. It's designed to maintain those properties. He does all the maintenance on the property. He has an excellent job, provides security for the property. And so, we're looking at this to maintain the property as well. And with those responsibilities, it's been commensurate with the bids that we've had. So we will go out, as it notes here, in the coming months, we will be going out, and we'll certainly consult with you, Director Crone, on that.
Okay.
Does the property have a future use by Eastern?
Potentially, yes. The properties also provide a buffer around the treatment facilities, so we don't have land uses moving right into a wastewater plant. Plus, it does provide us flexibility for future expansion of the plant. For example, some of the properties that we had historically retained and at least have in the last few years, for example, out in the San Jacinto area, we acquired property that's now part of our solar program where you need, you know, pretty good sized tracts of land to support the operations. But it's part, again, a buffer, which I think is very important as urbanization takes place, as well as opportunities to support future plant operations. And we do have expansions slated for all the plants.
Okay, and with that, I would move this item.
I'll second it. So we have a motion by Director Corona, a second by Director Pauly. May I get a roll call, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
That passes 5-0. With that, we'll go to item D, 5D. Director Armstrong, you have some questions?
Yeah, I also support this item as well. I just had a question. Just looking at the map and where it's located, is this, it looks like it's going to be a residential, you know, couple acre lot development. And I just think it's out there near Wine Country. I didn't know if it's going to be on septic or if it's going to be sewered. Did you, I don't know if staff knows that. My question was if it's in the Wine Country sewer.
Sure, I was just looking at the map. It's off of Cali Contento.
Right.
Maybe what we can do is look at the, I believe the sewer goes out this far on Cali Contento because it cuts over to Nichols, doesn't it, over that way?
Okay. Oh, okay.
So I think we'll get you more information on that.
Okay.
If that's okay. But yeah, again, the parcel in question fronts on Cali Contento.
Right.
So we will find that question out to that. And it's, of course, going to be based on the land use and what's going to be done out there. So certainly if it meets the requirements for septic or sewer system, they are going to have to sewer the property.
Yeah, so I didn't know if it was in that Wine Country sewer area or outside of it.
Yeah. I think so.
I think it is.
In that we will check on that, though. But okay. It is because, again, the location is next to Cali Contento, where the sewer is in place.
It will be a sewer annexation.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Good. All right. Then I'll make a motion to...
A motion by Director Armstrong.
I'll second.
Second by Director Corona. Would you please call the roll?
Director Pauly.
Aye.
Director Corona.
Aye.
Director Slauson.
Aye.
Director Armstrong.
Aye.
Director Record.
Aye.
That passes 5-0. With that, we'll move on to item 6, which is our action calendar. And first, we have item 6A, which is to approve and authorize Cactus Avenue Corridor Groundwater Wells Project CEQA Addendum Number 1. Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. Joe Broadhead with Environmental Regulatory Compliance here to present item 6A. CEQA Addendum Number 1 to the Cactus Avenue Corridor mitigated NAINC deck that was previously approved by the board about mid-year last year. For the agenda, I'll provide a quick overview of the Cactus Avenue Corridor project, then I'll provide you our findings with regards to the CEQA addendum that we prepared, and then I'll finish with a staff recommendation on the item. Cactus Avenue Corridor Project is a groundwater extraction, treatment, and distribution project designed to contain and remediate groundwater contamination and to increase potable water supplies for EMWD. The original project features that were addressed in the previous CEQA document included up to 6 extraction wells, a water treatment facility, and up to 30,000 linear feet of pipeline. We addressed all of those features within that NAINC deck, completed that NAINC deck last year, and the board approved it in May of last year. Since that time, there have been a few project modifications that have been identified, and we felt that it was best to address these modifications or these proposed modifications in an addendum to the NAINC deck. So those modifications included an additional extraction well in the north area, realigned pipelines around Victoriano Park within the public road right-of-way, and then we also took a look at 2 additional optional extraction well sites around Victoriano Park in case Victoriano Park was infeasible at the end of the day. The original map, which may look familiar to you, this is the facility map or the site map for the facilities that was originally approved back in May of 2020. At the top of the map is the north subarea with all of the well sites, the optional well sites, and the proposed treatment site. And then at the bottom of the map is the east subarea with, again, the well sites and the optional well sites. So this is the map of what was approved. Modifications that are being addressed in this addendum. In the north subarea, we have an additional well that, if approved, would be located on the site that was approved for the treatment plant. And in the east subarea, again, those two optional well sites, in case Victoriano Park was proved to be infeasible, we took a look at those within the addendum. And then we also took a look at rerouting a pipeline around Victoriano Park within the public road right-of-way. The findings of the CEQA addendum, taking a look at those modifications, was that there would be no substantial changes to the original project. The impacts that were identified were consistent with those that were identified for the original project. There was no new significant impacts that came from the proposed modifications. So all of that is to say that there are no major revisions to the previously approved mitigated NAICS deck, and that a CEQA addendum is the appropriate vehicle to address the proposed modifications. In summary, all the impacts remain less than significant after mitigation that was approved in the original document. Staff recommendation is for the board to approve addendum number one to the 2020 mitigated NAICS deck, and to authorize staff to prepare and file a notice of determination for the project. So that concludes my presentation on the item. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Do you have any questions? Director Slauson?
So, yes, Joe, the outside consultants used were the biology and air quality?
For the addendum?
For the addendum.
Correct, yeah, and we also took a look at cultural. There was the whole punch list of items in the original NAICS deck. We went back and we evaluated each of those items with the proposed modifications.
And determined those areas, cultural, biological, and air quality.
As well as about 15 other items.
Okay, correct. Okay. I just saw those in the additional studies. I think it's really good that we were able to do a lot of it in-house. I think that shows a lot of talent. And I think the analysis was good, and I'm glad we came to the conclusion we could do an addendum.
Thank you.
A big leap, good benefit to the project. Thank you.
Any other questions? Do I have a motion on the item?
I'd move approval.
Director Sloss will move the item.
Second.
Director Armstrong will second. Could I please get a roll call vote?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
And that passes 5-0. It'll move us on to item 6B, which is to approve an authorized water supply assessment for the SB2 planning grant program. Good morning.
Good morning, members of the boards of directors. I'm here to present on the water supply assessment. So this water supply assessment is located in the city of Hemet, and it's they're the lead agency for this project, and it's a 43-acre project that has 700 very high-density residential housing units, but only 10.2 of those acres is actually within the EMWD service area, and that part of the project is located on the northwest corner of State Street and Menlo Avenue, and so the water supply assessment that we've put together is only going to cover that portion of this project. This project is being led by the city of Hemet. They've indicated that they've closed escrow with a developer, but they did not identify that developer in their documentation. The city of Hemet has also noted in their documentation that they're interested in exploring a wheeling agreement for the remainder of the project that's not currently in the EMWD retail service area, But again, that's going to be outside the scope of this water supply assessment, because if we do a wheeling agreement, we would be providing their water. So in the 2015 Urban Water Management Plan, the land use that we anticipated for this area was mixed use, and this figure does show the portion that's highlighted in yellow is the portion of the project that is within our retail service area. And so when we compare the projected demands for this small area based on their proposed land use, which is very high density residential, we do see as a result of this shift an increase in the projected water use for this area. But it's a negligible amount relative to the total water use that was projected, and you know, just a negligible amount compared to our total retail service. And more critically, if we look at our demands since the completion of our 2015 Urban Water Management Plan, we see that our water use efficiency has significantly improved, and we're actually currently about 15,000 acre feet per year below our 2015 Urban Water Management Plan projections. I would also add that we're in the midst of our 2020 Urban Water Management Plan update at this time, and we will be incorporating this change in land use when we update our demand projections for that as well. So this will be accounted for in our future Urban Water Management Plan. And so, as a result, we would recommend that we approve and authorize this water supply assessment for the SB2 planning grant area in the city of Hemet. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Director Record, any questions?
No questions. I'll move approval.
I have one question.
Director Slauson had a question.
Is there a developer?
The city of Hemet has indicated that there is one, but they didn't tell us who it was. They just noted in their application that they have closed escrow.
Okay. Since I don't know if it's a developer I work for, I guess it's okay.
I'll second.
Okay, so we have a motion by Director Record. We have a second by Director Corona. With that, a roll call, please.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
I'll abstain.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
And the motion for the item passes 4-0 with Director Slauson abstaining. With that, I am going to suggest we take about a 7 or 8 minute break before we move into the budget presentation.
Thank you, Gordon. Thank you. What if it goes over to 9?
What?
Is that
there may be ramifications on that. All right, we will reconstitute the meeting here. I want to make sure Director Record is with us.
I'm with you.
All right. Thank you very much. Just make sure. We are now going to go to our informational items, and today it is budget workshop number one. And Mr. Adams, you have the floor.
All right. Well, good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. So this morning, as President Pauly mentioned, this is our first workshop, and the goal for today is to provide you with a high-level overview of our assumptions and some of the trends that we are seeing. As you know, the budget is really our main planning document, and the strategic plan plays an integral part in that development for both the two-year budget and the five-year capital plan. So quickly, this is our outline for today's presentation. I'm going to provide a brief calendar for the board and really highlight the key dates coming up for the board. We have several other workshops planned over the next few months, and then talk about the adoption that we have scheduled in June. Then I'm going to provide a brief overview of our financial planning and talk about some of our key initiatives that we are currently undergoing, including an update to our long-term financial plan, our development impact fee study, and some other integral parts of the budget process. And then next, for context, I want to provide you just a summary of the current fiscal year's budget, talk about operating expenses and some of our other major expenses like CIP and debt service. And then I'll jump into the budget assumptions and really focus on some of the key assumptions for some of our major costs, specifically related to personnel and our water costs. And then I want to switch gears a little. I want to give you an update on our OPEB and our OPEB trust and the funding status there, and talk about one of the other unfunded liabilities, specifically pensions, and talk about the strategy going forward. And then finally, just sort of talk about next steps, which will be workshop number two. So this is our timeline and on the calendar for the board. As you know, as I noted, workshop number one is today, and really to talk about key assumptions. We have a workshop number two next month, and then a third workshop in April. At that point, we will set the public hearing, hopefully for June 16th, which will include the adoption of the budget, and then also the approval of the rates. Any rate increase that would be suggested at that point would be going into effect the first of the year. I will say that staff has already started the budget process. Specifically, one of the first budget meetings I went to was related to capital back in October. Engineering spends a lot of time in developing and refining that five-year capital plan. So they've been working very hard over the past 3 months to refine that rolling five-year capital plan. In December, staff started working with HR on their staffing plans. Very critical because, as I'll discuss, personnel costs is almost 50% of our operating costs. And so HR working with departments, identifying their staffing needs going forward, really started in December. And then in January, finance started working on our projections and our assumptions that we're talking about here today. So with that, sorry. Want to talk about just the overview of our financial planning and to talk a little about how all these things interrelate. Certainly the two-year budget is our main financial planning document. We'll really set how resources are allocated over the next 2 years. The capital plan plays an integral part. We really use the water and sewer master plans to set that five-year capital plan, really identifying key projects and key timelines for those priorities to be implemented over the next 2 years, and then allocate funding over the next 2 years. And then as part of this, just identify resources. We will update our rates, take a closer look, and make adjustments accordingly in order to support that two-year plan. Reserve policy, one of the things that we are currently doing is updating our reserve policy. We're doing some specific analysis on our current status of our reserves. This is very important as we talk about resource allocation and how to support the five-year capital plan. And then our unfunded liabilities strategy. I talked a little about the OPEB. Have great news on the OPEB. Sort of want to turn our focus to pensions going forward. One of the studies that we are currently doing now, and I would anticipate this going to the board during the summer, is our connection fees. As you know, development is a very important component of our capital plan. A large portion is related to new development and growth. Connection fees represent $40 to $50 million, and so that really helps support that capital plan. And then finally, long-term financial plan, we are updating our model. The two-year budget will be used as our starting point for that 10-year forecast, and then we anticipate bringing that to the board after the adoption of the budget and as we go into next year. So that's something that I would expect to come to the board by the end of the year.
I have a quick question for
yes.
you on this slide.
Yes.
Is that rates? It looks like rates you're saying are going to be going down.
No.
No?
It's just the way that the inner the things are moving together. Right. So
I thought that was your joke. You were
no, but it's a great joke. And right. as I go through, if you have other questions or jokes.
So that's how the gears are supposed to be turning? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah. Yes.
Then it's wrong.
I'm not the best with.
The bottom line there on rates is not turning the right direction if you're working the gears right.
Okay.
The gears should be turning to the right.
Turning in the right direction.
Yeah.
Well, rates, if it goes around the other way, it's going up the other way, right, on the other side.
Now, so. If the budget's turning this way,
rates are going.
Gears should be turning the other way.
All right. Well, I'll.
No, you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
If I can say.
Yes.
This is getting more entertaining than I expected.
Promise to you, right, Director Slauson? All right.
Next slide.
Next slide. All right, with that, I feel a lot better now. So this is really to show you the overview of our operating budget. I want to focus on operating expenditures, roughly about 50%, but certainly other components, CIP, 93%. And if you add OFA, which is our other fixed assets, 30% of our budget is in capital, capital outlay, whether it's new projects, infrastructure, or fixed assets. Debt service right now is about $56 million. We anticipate that increasing about $59 million. The one thing I want to highlight is OPEB. This year we made contributions to the trust at $19 million. One of the good parts I will talk later is we anticipate being fully funded. So that will not be an expense going forward, which provides some relief on the budget, which certainly will impact rates. So with that said, want to talk briefly on district growth. When we talk about assumptions, there's the normal costs of inflation and how that impacts us providing services. But we thought it was important to really identify how the district has grown. And so, you know, as we'll talk about water sales and an increase of 2%. These are other metrics that help identify how the district has grown. Specifically on capital assets, we've added almost $300 million in capital assets. As we add assets, and I'll use Paris 2 as the example, we're going to increase some operating costs, right? And so you're going to have cost increase related to new infrastructure coming online. We talk about development activity and new customers. We've been growing from a development activity side about 1.6%. Certainly, you can see new customers we're adding 1.7% over the last few years. So really just to sort of give you a sense that overall, you know, growth is around 2% for us. And that sort of drives how we look at water sales and some of our other costs, that just because of this growth in either purchased water, we're seeing that growth from 2% when we have new customers. So just to give you an idea of sort of our assumption related to growth is 2% going in the next 2 years. So with growth, certainly there's always budget uncertainty. Certainly we never know when the next severe drought is going to hit us. I don't think anyone would have predicted, and especially it wasn't included in last year's two-year budget, the impacts of a pandemic. And so just really want to highlight a few impacts that provide some uncertainty going forward. Certainly at the top is the governor's shutoff order. This will have impacts and has had impacts related to our 61-plus day aging, which has significantly increased. Currently, that is at 24% of our total outstanding, and that continues to increase several percent each month. Another impact for this year was the suspension of late fees. This is typically budgeted around between $4 and $5 million. The suspension of that for this year certainly is appropriate to provide that relief for those that are behind. Going forward, you know, as far as how we budget that going forward, could have an impact on future revenues. I understand staff is coming back in March to provide some background on late fees and some recommendations, not just on how to re-implement the late fees, but also how to improve our collection process for those outstanding AR balances. I talk about AR balances outstanding right now as of January 30th. That number is $4.8 million, which is pretty significant in comparison to prior history, specifically related to the Great Recession. I'll show you a slide on that. And then briefly, just want to talk about interest earnings. We have benefited from low interest rates with managing our debt. On the other hand, we have a significant investment portfolio of over $500 million. Those rates have decreased literally 75% since our initial budget projections 2 years ago. Going forward, that has at least an impact when you look at what was budgeted 2 years ago to now, where it was $12 million and is now between $3 and $4 million going forward. So a $9 million impact there. So this slide, really this bar graph does a great example, or shows a great example of how accounts receivable have changed. So showing the purple bar is write-off since 2007, prior to the recession, and you see how that increased up to $1.4 million at the peak of the housing crisis. Of course, as the economy improved, that decreased over several years, getting back to what we consider a normal
prior to the recession about $700,000. And that trended that way for several years. You see a peak before the drought, but you see a decline after 2015. And this is really at the point which we implemented some late fee, but also changed the way that we shut off and did collections and really went after outstanding balances. That bottomed out at about $250,000 in 2019. We are projecting write-offs to be about $250,000 to $300,000 this year. So that's the good news. Now, the blue line actually shows you the percentage of outstanding AR that is 60 days plus. And even during the Great Recession, we hovered between 10 and 15%. With the executive order, that blue line you can see has spiked to 24%. So right now, we are suggesting, or at least until we get more information, anticipate write-offs over the next 2 years that are similar to what we saw in the Great Recession. Now, certainly a lot of uncertainty with what the governor decides and then what type of funding comes from federal and state agencies to help customers that have outstanding debt. We will continue to monitor that, but certainly it's not unreasonable to think that we're going to have significant increases in write-offs. Now, the plan will be to be very aggressive going after those in collections and use all methods possible, but certainly with the amount of outstanding debt, there's going to be a significant increase in AR write-offs. So with that, I'm going to talk briefly about operating expenses and really focusing on the two top ones, which is personnel and purchase water. Those two together represent 80% of our operating budget. And then if you include energy and chemicals, those four total are 90% of our operating costs. And so that's really where, you know, spend a little bit of time talking about our assumptions going forward. All right, so first of all, personnel. This slide or this bar graph is really to show how we have been relatively flat in staffing over the past or since 2014. We have only added nine positions since 2004. And if you think about growth, and we talked about the 1.8% every year, we've seen customer growth, you know, 20,000 plus accounts. Certainly water sales and infrastructure has increased, but we have had very minor 0.2% on average increase in personnel since 2014. Of course, you know, certainly this is, you know, our use of technology and, you know, process improvement and being very efficient in our utilization of resources. We do anticipate proposing a few positions, which I'll discuss on the next slide. But you can see that there were years in which we actually had declines in FTE counts. But just to show you, we've been very flat on the allocation of new full-time equivalents. Sure, I cover that. So wages and benefit assumptions. I mentioned the four new positions, really in two major areas, two new electrical apprentices that are anticipated to be proposed for next fiscal year, and then two GIS analysts. These are really part of the GIS master plan that was adopted by the board, one position this next year and then one in 2023. For cost of living adjustments for employees, currently we're modeling 2%. Of course, that will be indexed based on the actual change in CPI. This past year was about 2%. You know, at this point, that is a number we're using to model out what the costs changes will be and then how that impacts rates. And then merit increases. Right now, we're modeling 2.5%. We have, you know, this is a very seasoned workforce. People have been here for a long period of time. And a lot of people that are at the top of the range. So certainly with new employees coming in, there are increases there. But overall, 2.5% across the board. Medical, which is about $11.5 million, we're anticipating a 5% increase overall. This is very similar to this past year. Even CalPERS had a 4.4% increase in their overall health plans over the past for 2021. Interesting, on, about 0.5% was actually related to the impacts from COVID. Pension contributions, and I'll talk a little more about our liabilities later, our normal cost is actually declining, 3%, so it's going from 10.3% down to 10%. This is really because as we see retirements and new people coming into the organization, they're under the new, you know, the new pension plans that have lower benefits going forward. So those are considered PEPRA members. Those members and that class of employee is increasing while we see retirements. The one area of concern is our unfunded actuarial liability payment, or what we call our UAL. That is actually increasing 16%. So it's going from 10.6, I believe, up to $12.3 million, and then 9% in 2023. This is supposed to peak out at about $16.6 million in the next five to seven years. And then finally, OPEB, we made a huge contribution in July. We do not anticipate any additional contributions and only making the minimum ADC payments. All right. So just briefly, water sales and supplies, as I mentioned earlier, we're projecting 2% increase in water sales, mainly from increase in domestic demand. You can certainly see in last fiscal year, the actuals were about 78,000 acre feet. Currently, it's trending at about 81,000 acre feet. You know, we're still early. We're only halfway through the year. So we'll continue to monitor that and then project out. And then we talk about 2% forecast going forward in the next 2 years. You know, the increase from 20 to 21 is a little over 3%, and we look at the increase that happened in 1920, it was about 2.6%. So right now, just a 2% increase anticipated. And then production, there's still a lot of work to be done on this. I will say that operations is still coming up with refined numbers specifically related to the desalter production. Certainly with Paris 2 coming on, that number is going to increase. Any increase there will decrease our purchased water cost. And then well production, currently it's trending about 16,000 acre feet. I would anticipate with the desalter and some other activities that that may go down. We'll find out from operations once they come back with some refinements. All right, water supply cost. Just briefly, this is what MWD is charging us for purchased water. What we do know for sure is the 2022 rates, which we anticipate an overall 4% increase. 2023 is projected at 5%. Paul earlier mentioned, and I just want to bring them up really quick, water stewardship fee, which is the fourth line down. You see that currently at $0 and next year at $0, but increasing back to 53. That certainly is a preliminary estimate of them, but that is a major focus right now for the rate refinement group. And then Tier 1 full service untreated and full service treated Tier 1. Certainly untreated is only increasing 2.8%, but in the second year is going up 6.6%. About a third of our purchased water is untreated, I believe, and then full service treated is about two-thirds, and so 3.5 and then 4.6. You know, certainly the 4% we know, 5% could change. You know, the water stewardship fee is a good example of something that's still pending.
Can I ask a quick on that? Yes. 5% increase? I didn't understand. Is that including the potential water stewardship fee, or is that?
Ooh, you know, I believe it does. Even though you don't see, I knew that question was going, and I meant to run the calcs previous. I'm sorry. So this table is directly
from. Assume that yes, if you look at on the line item.
Okay.
It assumes an equivalent fee to connect that amount in 2023.
Gotcha.
As I mentioned in my report, the Met staff suspended the collection of that fee. They still have funding in their reserves to be able to fund those until 2023, but something is going to need to go in place. So what we showed on the chart there under what it may not be called the water stewardship fee. It may be a component of one of the other fees, but for planning purposes, if you incorporated that back into the rate structure, it would be 5%.
Okay. Yeah. So that puts the 5% there. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. So I talked personnel, again, 46%. We talked about purchase water, which is 34%. So there's your 80%. So going to other operating costs, we talked, you know, energy and chemicals are the next two highest. Right now we're projecting between 4 and 6 in year one and then 7 and 9. Certainly, there is a pending rate case for Southern California Edison that has rate increases between 18 and 21%, pretty significant. Fortunately for us, this is being offset by solar. We have a solar project that's going live hopefully July 1st, but that certainly will offset that cost increase. We have seen over last year, I think the overall increase was about 20% on energy. We're anticipating 12%. So we have been really hit hard on our energy costs and thus the focus on solar energy. Chemicals, this year we had significant increases on chemicals. Looking out at our purchase contracts and for chemicals over the next 2 years, we really do see increases between 4 and 5%. I think next year is 4.4, and I think it increases to 4.8% in the second year. I categorized outside services, materials and supplies, rental equipment and maintenance agreements, really to track with CPI and cost of inflation. 2 to 3%, just some nuances within the line item detail of how those are increasing. But overall, we would anticipate increase between 2 and 3%, really to give you context. And then next, solid waste hauling. Certainly, we're seeing increases from haulers. There's an increase in fuel prices. We're anticipating a 4.4 to 5% increase over the next 2 years, pretty consistent. As far as SOPA fees, there's actually a budget workshop that I'm participating in the next month. We'll have a better sense of what that increase is, but at this point, anticipating 2 to 3%. If that should change, I will update the board at the next workshop. So that's overall operating costs. I'm going to jump into the next three major components. First, with capital improvement. This next two-year cycle anticipates, at least currently, about $33 million in grant funding. We have been very successful. If you look at the prior 3 years, we have received over $80 million in grant funding. So it's a pretty significant portion of our funding for our capital projects. You can see in 2022 and 2023 that we anticipate between 95 and 105 in internal funded capital projects, mainly from new growth and development that will be supported by connection fees, but there are other projects there. So that plan continues to be refined. We'll have a better update at the next workshop for the board. But that gives you the context. It's very similar the next 2 years to the current 21 budget. So, all right, operating fixed assets, which we call OFA, and debt service. So OFA, we do not have a projection yet, but I want to give you context. So currently the budget is about $38 million and includes our CIS project, which is our main billing system, which is several millions in the tens of millions of dollars. That is, that project is coming to end and won't necessarily be included in the next two-year budget. With that said, if you look at our past 5 years, our average spend or expenditures for the past 5 years has been about $20 million. So no question, I would anticipate seeing a significant reduction there. The one thing that is not included, which I want to bring up and you're more than aware of, is our ERP. We are in the current early stages of that assessment. I would anticipate if there's any funding required for that project going forward, it will be brought to the board later this year and would be part of the second year of the two-year budget. And then quickly, debt service. I mentioned earlier it's $56 million. We do see an increase up to $59 million. You can see how debt service is pretty smooth over the next several years. I will say there's one caveat. Right now we're doing analysis on our variable rate debt. If we decide to fix that out, or that makes the most economic sense, it will have a short-term impact on our interest costs and could increase our debt service over the first 2 years. But at this point, we'll be making that. We're doing the analysis now. We'll be making that recommendation to the board in April, and then at that point, that will be incorporated into the budget. All right, so I'm going to switch gears a little, talk about our employer long-term liabilities. I should get caught up on my slides. So the first one, I want to go back to, we talked about the strategic plan and its impact on how we prioritize resources and really focus on trying to accomplish that plan. The board, in their three-year strategic plan, this was one of the goals, and I won't read it verbatim, but it's more or less execute the plan to fully fund our long-term liabilities. This was not just OPEB, but also pension. We have, and happy to report, EMWD has done an amazing job executing that plan to address OPEB. I mentioned earlier, and I'll show you now, that plan will, at least that liability is fully funded. I'm highlighting the box at the bottom, which says that we need to reevaluate the funding based on a new valuation. We are currently starting that process, and we'll have an update to the board on the actual status within the next 90 days. With that said, I want to show you the history of OPEB and go back to 2013, when those policy principles were adopted by the board, really showing you that back in 2014, we were 10% funded. That's the green, or that's the purple line. And you can see that that green is the market value of the assets, where the blue is the liability. And that purple line is our funded status. And you can see we started making contributions, additional contributions in 2017, 2016, 17, 18, 19, and then most recently in 2020. And that has increased to 85% funded. So that is significant when you talk about OPEB. I mean, very few agencies are above 80%. That said, myself and Laura Nomura and Laura Zamora met with CalPERS last November. And this is the slide that they provide us to sort of give us an update on the success that we've had with the OPEB Trust. And this is through October 31st of last year. You can certainly see when we opened up the trust in 2012, we made that initial contribution of $5.8 million. We have made $115 million in additional contributions since 2012. Now, the trust has funded benefits and has reimbursed us for benefits paid of about $27 million, but sort of highlighting the interest earnings, which has significantly offsetted those benefits at a little over $20 million. And then I'm really highlighting the total assets, $114 million in total assets. And you saw earlier that the liability last time we did our valuation was $108 million. So certainly the trust has performed very well over, since 2012 at 6%. So it's reasonable at this point to anticipate that the OPEB trust or OPEB liability is fully funded, and we're in great shape there. So that's a great news. I want to talk a little about our pension liability. If you remember, the strategic plan objective was to do both OPEB and pensions. And certainly when we look back at 2014, we were only 10% on OPEB. So really the focus made sense to focus on OPEB at that point. And if you look at where pensions were, 2014, we were at 75%, and it was trending up. Unfortunately, based on either assumptions that have changed or performance of the trust, we really have been hovering around that 70%, and that's the purple line. You can see that assets have grown with the liability in similar proportions, so that's the 70%. But now that OPEB has been addressed, we do need to sort of change our focus and start looking at how to address this unfunded pension liability. Certainly, with being in CalPERS, there is a funding strategy to pay that UAL. Currently, that UAL or that unfunded liability is scheduled to be funded over the next 24 years. which I'll talk briefly about here. So our current status, 68% unfunded liability, $154 million. And next year's UAL payment is 12.3. I mentioned earlier, we anticipate this to increase to 16.6, I think, in 2026, 27. And it will peak out and then decline over time. We are looking at various options. I think there's really two that I want to focus on that, you know, CalPERS even talks in their actuarial about. The first one is what we call fresh start. So it takes the amount that you owe, and that's being amortized over that 22 years, and it reduces it to 15 years. This would increase our costs by the $4.3 million per year. And if you think about the OPEB savings or the payments we're not making to OPEB, which is $19 million, certainly we could potentially afford that $4.3. It would pay off that unfunded liability within 15 years and actually save us $38 million. The other option, which provides a little more flexibility, is that we simply make what we can afford at the time additional discretionary contributions. I use $9 million as the example to just show you that if you pay $9 million additional every year, that unfunded liability would be paid off in 10 years. So that would be a little more aggressive, of course, an increase in our cost. And then just talking about managing with CalPERS, you can put the money with CalPERS. You can also set up a separate trust similar to that we did with OPEB. That could be managed by CalPERS or another agency. This provides some flexibility. In case we have severe financial crisis, you can use those funds to pay for your current costs. So it provides some flexibility. But right now, staff is evaluating these options. I think as we put together the budget, looking at what we can afford, what makes the most sense, we'll come back to the board with a plan or recommendations for your consideration. So with that, mostly done. Here's our schedule, just to talk that our next meeting, our workshop number 2, is March 17th. We talk about the third workshop in April. Certainly start the noticing process for any rate increase that may occur, and then adoption on the 16th. So with that, I am done. Certainly available for any questions and welcome those.
That was fun.
It was, okay. All right, a little nervous, but I got over it.
No need to be nervous, but I'm sure the board does have some questions. So, Director Armstrong, would you like to start?
Sure. I thought that was a really good presentation, and I actually enjoyed it very much. So,
thank you.
I think just to go back to a couple meetings ago, I still feel that. And even your slide highlighted sort of the times we're in right now and the uncertainties. And I still feel like there's a lot of pressure on our customers. And it's maybe extra important in these times to do whatever we can do to minimize and mitigate the pressures that we're facing as an organization and to hold down those rate increases and totally support, as Director Slauson mentioned a number of times, you know, you don't want to go without rate increases and then have these spikes. You want to have, you know, smaller, manageable rate increases. Yeah. And so I support all that. But at the same time, I really do think that it's a time to really look for ways to mitigate the pressures instead of just passing them on. So one question I have for you is, are there efforts that take place during the budget process with staff to look for ways to reduce the pressures and...
There will be. And I think, you know, talking about, and I talked briefly that we've already started the process. Departments' requests are really due the end of this week. We will start that analysis and start putting those numbers and other stuff in the model to figure out where, you know, where we are and then take a closer look. There's no question. I think not to say we're not, to avoid being tone deaf. We are completely aware of our environment and sort of agree, we need to make incremental increases to rates to avoid those future increases. But we have to step back and remember the environment in which we are. And certainly, you know, I think all of us would love to come and say to provide the lowest increase as possible and be fiscally prudent and thoughtful on what are the long-term impacts. So there's no question. I think once we see where the numbers are, then start going back and looking at that. And, you know, just talking about OPEB, the OFA budget, I mean, things that we had some major costs when the economy was doing well and rate increases, you know, at 3% were reasonably expected. Going forward, you know, we would anticipate reductions there, and hopefully that will buffer some of the other increases we're seeing.
Well, I would just ask, maybe as you go through the process, if you, you know, here's kind of where the pressure is and here's where we're at, and here's some of the things that we've done to mitigate it and help, maybe you could just kind of show, you know,
okay,
here's what we, you know, this is what the rates would be if we didn't do this, and we did these things that brought the pressure, the rates down to this, even given the pressure. It's just something that we can see that, you know, the staff did this, and it's something that you can go back to your constituents and say, no, they worked really hard, and, you know, you can't offset all of it, but they were able to do this. You know, so that would be something that would be nice to see as you go through it. The other thing is, I compliment you on the OPEB.
I can't take any credit. It's
the organization and what you guys have done. It's really incredible, and I would wholeheartedly support an aggressive approach for the pensions as well.
Agreed.
And I think there's both of those alternatives. Maybe it's even a hybrid where you're using both of them, where you're making a discretionary contribution. That gives you immediate relief from your pension costs, which you could use to then offset rate increase, you know, as well as the section or whatever other tool you would use out there for a different trust. I think that other trust has a lot of benefits too, because you don't want to put all your money, I don't think, in CalPERS and get 100% funded with CalPERS, because there's risks in the future. If things turn around, investment returns are great, and now you're overfunded and there's nothing you can do about it. So I would support both of those efforts in an aggressive way, because I think you're addressing a liability that's growing at a higher cost than what you're earning.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, 10 years at 5 years, I mean, I would support something aggressive on that. So I hope you come up with a good plan on that.
Appreciate your feedback. I mean, just talking about OPEB and being fully funded, that that trust is invested in their strategy one, which is extremely aggressive. That will be part of the discussion we have about how to change that makeup of the investment strategy and maybe, you know, reducing volatility, maybe take a lower rate, but that's okay when you're fully funded. So I appreciate the feedback, and it is a major unfunded liability we need to be aggressive on, and the board has done an amazing job on the OPEB. So
my comments.
Director Slauson?
I have no questions.
Director Corona? Director Record, any questions on the budget presentation?
I've got a couple of comments, and I agree with Director Armstrong. We need to be aware of people that are struggling and do everything we can to try to help that, and I think we do. I'm more concerned with some of the unknowns. I mean, we've already heard about what the cost of power is doing. Just from what I see personally as a businessman, everything is going up dramatically. Steel, lumber, fertilizer, you name it, it's going up. And so we have to be aware of that and try to plan for it. So I appreciate the budget process, and I feel like we've had some really good discussions over the years, and it's really a time for the board to be that conduit to the community that we represent and provide input and really look closely at what staff presents and ask a lot of questions. So I think we're off to a good start.
Thank you, Director Record. I'm going to tee off of Director Record's comments. One of the things I might like to see is, you know, where are we if they tell us CPI is 2%, that I may disagree personally with that.
Yeah.
But I'd like to see perhaps on our costs, can we get a slide that projects out maybe a 5% inflation index over the next couple of years, of what that would do to energy and other things, just so.
No question. Certainly at the next workshop, we can talk about sort of just
Maybe we
sensitivity do a, analysis related yeah. to certain increases at certain levels and what the impacts would be on rates. Yeah.
And then on the OPEB discussion, the pension discussion, I mean, you know, I was here in previous boards, Director Record, Director Slauson. We did have to make tough decisions. I got to tell you, when you go back to your ratepayers and say, well, the rates are this because we have to fund medical trust or we have to fund pension obligations. Yeah. That's the cost of doing business in the environment that we're in. I want to make sure our employees here that provide that great service for our customers are always taken care of. But, Director Armstrong, you hit it. It's a tough discussion to have versus rates versus the kind of costs that we have obligations for. And I agree I'd like to maybe look at some other alternatives, or at least address to the board other alternatives to the CalPERS issue. So
okay, appreciate.
I'd look forward to getting that kind of presentation too. But finally, I want to say I know this is your first year going through a budget here, but I think you're off to a very good start. And I do appreciate the information, and I look forward to future budget workshops. So
all right, well, thank you. So.
Yeah, and just to clarify, I want to address those pension liabilities for the employees, and I think there's a generational equity issue too of who's funding some of these liabilities. But I think for every dollar you address that liability, it reduces your operating costs from CalPERS tremendously because you're addressing that unfunded liability, and that results in savings to the customers. So,
yeah, I mean, if you think about the 154 million, I mean, we're paying 7% on that on an annual basis, and that is, I don't want to say crazy, but that is not good. So we need to address that sooner than
like
later.
I said, I'm proud of what the board did on the OPEB thing. I just
amazing.
You know, it those are tough decisions you have to make.
Yeah.
When we had an extra pot of money to put that into OPEB, which I today think was the right decision, I think the math is agreeing with that. But, you know, given the climate and ratepayers situations, too, those are tough questions for the board. So look forward
I think your points and Director Armstrong's points well taken. We do need to address those issues, but it's a balance.
Mm-hmm.
Because Director Armstrong, to your point, I think that's why we put that in this part of the presentation, we need to now turn our focus on the PERS liability. But as you know, it's going to take money generated from our margin, from our rates, to be able to put into those accounts to realize those significant long-term savings. And I think the board's done a good job on the OPEB. We had an original schedule that was much longer. When the board, we had good years where our margin exceeded our budget. We put that money right into the OPEB, and I would hope on a going-forward basis the board would adopt a similar philosophy, that if we do have higher sales or we do have a slight increase to our margin over what was budgeted, that kind of automatically gets put in towards the pension liability. It's like a kind of a long-term investment. And I agree with Director Armstrong. If you look at that amount and the 7% we're paying on that, that's a huge long-term liability. And if we can get that down and start to put money into that now, what we're going to see is that's going to flatten down and have less rate pressure on our customers in the future, and I think that serves them very well. So we really appreciate the feedback on this. This has been very good, and we'll come back with some ideas.
Yeah. But again, if we could get kind of that inflation-adjusted possibilities on a slide, if your Excel spreadsheet would allow you to do that without too much effort, I know I'd be interested in seeing that.
I think that's a great idea, and we'll do that on the next
very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We will move on to item number 8, which is a receive and file. I'll look for a motion to second on the receive and file items.
Make that motion.
Director Armstrong moves it.
One second.
Director Cronus,
I'll give it Director Record can second it. Can I get a roll call, please?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
And that passes 5-0. That will take us to item 9, which are calendar review. And I understand that Shayla is going to do the calendar review this morning.
Good morning, Director Pauly, members of the board. I will be going over the board calendar review for the next 3 months. Listed on the first page of your calendar review is one event that the board has been invited to participate in.
On Friday, February 26th, the Riverside County Water Task Force speaker series will be taking place. There is a flyer with more information about the speakers on page 5 if any of you are interested in participating. Moving on to page 2, we have the board master calendar for the next 2 weeks. On Wednesday, February 17th at 1 p.m., the Urban Water Institute Virtual Spring Conference will kick off on day 1 for Director Armstrong and Record. At 3 p.m., the recycled water use discussion will be taking place for Director Record's calendar. On Thursday, February 18th at 7:30 a.m., the Board Executive Committee meeting will take place for Director Polly and Record. At 8 a.m., the Urban Water Institute Virtual Spring Conference Day 2 will be taking place for Director Armstrong and Record. On Monday, February 22nd at 11 a.m., the Cal-DSAL Executive Committee meeting will take place for Director Polly. And at 4 p.m., the Hemet San Jacinto Water Master meeting will also be taking place for Director Polly. On Tuesday, February 23rd, the Met committee meetings will be taking place for Director Record. And at 3:30 p.m., the Board Operations and Engineering Committee meeting will take place for Director Armstrong and Slauson. On Wednesday, February 24th at 9 a.m., the Aqua Washington, D.C. virtual conference will be held for Director Armstrong. And at 10:30 a.m., the MODOC Virtual Water Policy Forum will be held for Director Polly's calendar. On Thursday, February 25th at 7 a.m., the general manager interviews will begin, and that is a 2-day event, followed with the Friday, February 26th at 9 a.m. Also on Friday, February 26th at 7:30 a.m. is the Riverside County Task Force Speaker Series, which I just mentioned. On Monday, March 1st at 2 p.m., the WRCOG Executive Committee meeting will be held for Director Polly. And on Tuesday, March 2nd at 9:30 a.m., the SOPA Commission meeting workshop will be held, and that's for Director Slauson's calendar. Moving on to page 3, we have a list of key events as well as the upcoming board and committee meetings for the next 3 months. And on page 4, the joint interagency meetings for the next 3 months are also listed. And that concludes my report, unless there's any questions that the board may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. We will go to the director's attendance reports. We'll start with Director Armstrong.
Okay. I attended the Menifee Masters program on February 4th. This is a program put on by the city of Menifee, geared towards, I think, mostly real estate professionals, but it was really well done. The city presents from all of their departments, economic development, their planning department, fire and police, and then all the utilities also make a presentation. So Eastern made a presentation to them. Amanda Fine did that, did a really great job. I just decided to participate in the whole thing the whole day because it was just really informative, and thought it was great that we participate in that, and I thought it was very valuable for the attendees. The Eastern Elsinore interagency meeting, I thought, you know, staff did a really good job on sharing and talking about some things that we have in common that we're working on. Talked about sewer in Quail Valley, talked about PFAS and PFOA and some of those testing and sampling that's going on. So I thought that was a good meeting. Really enjoyed my meeting with the general manager, very prepared. And I thought it was wonderful because it really did touch on all the major highlights of things going on at the district. So it was very informative for me, so I appreciated that. Customer service call center tour. That was really, I went to the customer service call center, which is the satellite facility, and saw the billing, the call center, and the meter department supervisors, and met with them. And It was really informative, and I just want to give my compliments to them. They're very, some very innovative approaches that they're using at the call center. A lot of analytics where they're monitoring how things are taking place, and they have these teams out there. The customer service groups are separated into teams, and they sort of, you know, in a good way, compete with each other to do better than the other team did the last month. And I just thought that was some really creative stuff. One of the real innovative things I thought is in the meter side where you have, I think it's 300 meters that we're kind of piloting on the meters that you have the ability to do the remote disconnect and reduce the flow. And they were strategically targeted at certain accounts that made sense, and I just thought it was really good innovation. Really appreciated the time for staff to take me through there, and so that was that. That was really good. And then, not on the list, but I did want to mention, I did attend the Marietta Temecula Group meeting, and I just wanted to mention it because they had the CEOs from the three hospitals, the Temecula Valley, Loma Linda, and Rancho Springs and Inland Valley over there in Marietta and Temecula. And they all talked about COVID and what happened over the last few months and when things spiked back in January at the hospitals and where things are now. And they kind of spiked to about 150% of their hospital capacities in January. And they felt like they could even do more than that in terms of space at the hospitals. Their challenge was personnel and getting skilled nurses and physicians there. And so you had to go out of state to get those to come here. Otherwise, you're just stealing from another hospital that needs the same personnel. And special waivers were allowed for those personnel to come out of state and help in California without certain certifications. But anyways, that was their biggest challenge. They felt like they've turned the corner. They've turned the peak on it. They said 60% of their staff at the hospitals have gotten the vaccine, and there's a certain amount of those that just don't want to get it. But with physicians, much higher percentage getting the vaccine. Encourage you to get the shots. So anyways, they felt like we're turning the corner. So anyways, those are my updates.
All right, thank you so much. I'm glad you got the tour of the call center. It is something I would encourage every director who's interested to do. It's a fascinating operation. Like I said, that is our cash register here at the district, so it has to function well. Director Corona.
I attended the Rancho California Water District board meeting. The big topic of conversation at that board meeting was the Western Murrieta Division, and a lot of discussion about the report from the consultant. They, I guess, they were a little bit disappointed in the results, and they, the end all and be all. I guess they intend to write a little bit of an addendum to their proposal, I guess, and try to correct a few things regarding ad valorem taxes and the like. That's my report.
Very good. Appreciate that. I attended the CalDESAL annual conference. It was virtual this year, which, again, I state for the record, not a huge fan of virtual conferences, but it is what it is. So I think Jeff also attended. I found it really good. Again, some fascinating panelists, a lot of some people from the environmental community off the East Coast on a couple panels. Of Massachusetts, and getting to understand and hear that, say, even in some of the environmental communities, they understand that desal may not be the worst thing ever, ocean desal. And so I think overall in the desal community, we're making some progress on that. And then also a few good panels on groundwater desal, which we're very interested in here, obviously. So again, for a virtual conference, I think it was well. I also had a financial update with John Adams, excuse me, and talked to him about a few things, including our discussion on the inflation issues. So that was good. Also getting to know our new finance director a little better. And then I had a meeting with the – I'm the treasurer of the Hemet San Jacinto Water Master, so I had to do our annual questions for the auditor as the audit's coming up. So this is my report. Director Record.
Yes, Joint Inland Caucus with Orange County to review Met agenda. Good discussion as usual. Finance and Insurance Committee agenda review. It's just the chair and vice chair of Finance and Insurance Committee that will go over the agenda prior to the committee meeting the following week. Standing committee and board meetings, you have a MWD update printout, which is a good summary of what happened. There's nothing too much out of the ordinary. I would say that we have quite a changeover in the board lately from several cities in one district, which is going to change the makeup of the board somewhat. And a lot of things that are coming up that are going to be really important that will have a great impact on our agency. Probably number one, the discussion about rates, but also the selection of the new general manager. And that's my report.
All right. Thank you, Director Record. And finally, Director Slauson.
I attended the Moreno Valley Hispanic Chamber presentation. They had it's their monthly meeting, but Chamber of Commerce meeting. And Alma and Consuelo from our community involvement group did the presentation. They did excellent. And it was well received by the participants, the other participants in the meeting. I had on February 11th update with the general manager. It's always good to have additional details and some of the background information, so I appreciated that. And yesterday at SAPA, we welcomed Jeff Mosher, our new GM. That was his first meeting, and we authorized the issuance of a task order for Tiemann, Ramirez, and Smith for audit services, and we had a closed session. That's it, with nothing reported out.
All right. Very well. That will bring us to director's comments and future agenda items. Anybody have a comment or future agenda item? Director Record, anything?
No.
Okay, very good. I have one I wanted to announce as the WRCOG representative for Eastern, that Rick Bishop, the longtime general manager of WRCOG, I think he's been there for 20 years, has announced that he is retiring in March, and the committee is, I think, going to do a nationwide search and look for a new executive director for an organization. Rick has done, in my opinion, a fantastic job with that, and it's going to be some big shoes to fill. But more on that, but I just wanted to note that he is retiring, and I'm sure at some point when all the resolutions and things are done, we'll want to participate in that. So. Mr. Legal Counsel, I understand we have a need for closed session.
We do, Mr. Chair, as identified as items 11A and B. One matter is potential litigation under Government Code Section 54956.9. The second item is concerns of general manager recruitment update under Government Code Section 54957.
All right. With that, we will take a few minutes and get into closed session mode here. Until March 3rd, 2021 at 9 a.m.
Thank you.
Absolutely.